I want you to picture something in your mind's eye for a second. Imagine you are holding a silver spoon.
Okay, a silver spoon.
Yeah, and pooled right in the center of that spoon is this thick, dark, slightly reddish honey.
Oh, that sounds nice. Like a rich artisan variety.
Exactly. I mean, if you hold it up to the light, it looks like an absolute gourmet treat, like something you would maybe drizzle over some artisanal cheese or, you know, a fresh biscuit.
Right, something you'd get at a high-end farmer's market.
Exactly. And if you bring it close, it smells just a tiny bit bitter, maybe a little earthy, but mostly it just looks incredibly sweet. It looks innocent.
Honey always does, yeah.
But, and this is the crazy part, that specific spoonful holds a secret that is so incredibly potent. It has quite literally brought entire ancient armies to their knees.
Which is just a wild thing to think about.
It really is. I mean, it is capable of causing vivid, terrifying delusions. And it can bring the human heart to an absolute shuddering crawl.
The cognitive dissonance of that visual is just powerful because we are so evolutionarily hardwired to trust honey.
Oh, totally. It's the ultimate safe food.
Exactly. Across almost every human culture, you know, honey represents something sweet, natural, restorative, and safe. I mean, it's literally one of our oldest foods.
Right.
But this particular variety completely subverts that expectation. It takes the ultimate symbol of natural nourishment and, well, it turns it into a biological weapon.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we are taking a deep dive into what is colloquially known as mad honey, or as it is famously known in Turkey, deli ball.
Deli ball, right.
Yeah. And our exploration today is anchored by this massive, really comprehensive article from the OOTW Journal. It basically pulls together the botany, the cardiology, and the deep historical record of this substance.
It's a fantastic source, really thorough.
It is. And our mission today is to explore the full story of mad honey. We're going to trace it from the specific flowers and the bees that produce it down into the, like, microscopic biological hijacking of human nerve cells.
Which is a fascinating process. It's unbelievable. And then we'll track its impact all the way back to ancient Roman battlefields and even to the sheer cliff faces of the Himalayas, where people are literally still risking their lives to harvest it today.
But before we delve into the molecular mechanics of how all this works, we really need to establish a very clear baseline about what we are actually discussing.
Oh, for sure. Good point.
Because if you spend any time browsing the internet or, you know, looking at social media trends lately, you will see mad honey heavily branded and marketed as a psychedelic.
Yeah, I've seen that everywhere, like hallucinogenic honey.
Right. There is this whole subculture of thrill seekers who talk about it as this natural mystical high.
Mm.
But the chemical reality of what this honey actually does to the human body is much stranger.
Right, and way more dangerous, right?
Inherently much more dangerous than that psychedelic label implies. So we are here to impartially report the medical, historical, and chemical facts presented in our source material. We are just exploring the science.
Exactly. Just the facts. We are absolutely not providing medical advice, and we are unequivocally not endorsing the consumption of toxic substances.
I am so glad you drew that line right up front, because treating this like some kind of recreational psychedelic is just fundamentally misinterpreting the biology.
Right. You're completely misunderstanding what you're eating.
Exactly. We're talking about pharmacology here, not a weekend trip.
Mm.
And the science of this starts with a really foundational premise in ecology. Basically, honey is only as safe as the flowers the bees visit to make it.
That is so true. I mean, honey doesn't simply manifest out of thin air, you know.
Right. It's not just magic bee juice.
Exactly. It is a highly concentrated reflection of the local botanical environment. When you eat honey, you are essentially eating a distilled essence of all the flora within maybe a 3 to 5 mile radius of that specific hive.
Oh, well, up to 5 miles.
Yeah. Bees are incredible foragers. And the source of the toxicity we are talking about today originates from very specific, highly defensive plants. We're talking about certain species of rhododendron.
Okay, so the OTW Journal specifically highlights Rhododendron ponticum and Rhododendron luteum. Those are the primary culprits here.
Those are the big ones, yeah.
And for those trying to picture the geography in their head, these plants grow incredibly densely around the Black Sea coast of Turkey, particularly up in the Pontic Alps.
Yes, and also throughout the Caucasus region.
Right. It's this lush, mountainous environment where these shrubs just completely dominate the understory of the forests, like everywhere you look.
And the dominance of those plants is key here because rhododendrons, from an evolutionary biology standpoint, have developed intense chemical defense mechanisms.
Oh, to stop animals from eating them.
Exactly, to prevent herbivores from munching on their leaves and their flowers. So the nectar in these specific rhododendron flowers is just laden with these defensive toxins.
Oh, it's basically poison nectar.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And when spring arrives and these mountainy sides just erupt into bloom, there is a massive localized concentration of this toxic nectar.
And here's the crazy part. The bees that forage in these areas, they don't seem to care at all.
No, they love it.
While reading the source material, one of the most striking details to me was the fact that the bees themselves are just completely immune. I mean, they drink this highly toxic nectar, and their own nervous systems just shrug it right off.
What's fascinating here is that it's a remarkable quirk of evolutionary physiology. The ion channels in the nervous system of a honeybee actually have a slightly different structural conformation than those in a mammal.
So the key literally doesn't fit the lock for the bee.
Exactly. Nature has essentially created a perfect chemical Trojan horse. The danger is entirely reserved for the consumer, not the producer.
I just look at the bees in this scenario as these unwitting botanical smugglers, you know?
Ah, botanical smugglers. I like that.
I mean, they fly out to these rhododendrons, they load up on this intense chemical payload, and they cross the border right back into the hive. They have no idea they are hauling contraband.
They're just doing their job.
Right. And the worst part is the manufacturing process itself. Because as they process that raw nectar into honey, they fan it with their little wings to evaporate the water and concentrate the sugars.
Right, which makes the honey thick.
But by evaporating the water, they're also inadvertently concentrating the plant's toxins right there in the comb. I mean, the dose gets significantly stronger.
They are literally refining the poison. And we should probably clarify what this contraband actually is. Returning to that distinction we made earlier between a true psychedelic and what is happening here.
Right, because it's not a psychedelic.
Right. Classic psychedelics. So substances like LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, they are typically nitrogen-containing compounds. They're known as alkaloids.
Okay, alkaloids. Got it.
And they operate primarily by binding to serotonin receptors in the human brain. That's what alters your perception, your mood, your visual processing.
Well, I was looking at the chemical diagrams of the toxins in the journal, and they look completely different from something like psilocybin.
Oh, entirely different structure.
Yeah, the molecules in mad honey lack those distinct nitrogen rings. So if they aren't interacting with serotonin receptors at all, what exactly are we dealing with here?
Well, we are dealing with a class of molecules called granotoxins.
Granotoxins.
Yes. Rather than being nitrogen-heavy alkaloids, granotoxins are a family of over 24 diterpene molecules.
Okay, and what exactly is a diterpene?
Diterpenes are essentially these complex lipid-soluble structures. They're built from a carbon-hydrogen backbone, and because of their specific physical shape and that lack of nitrogen you mentioned, they simply do not interface with serotonin receptors.
They just bounce right off.
Exactly. The journal actually highlights two specific variants that do the vast majority of the damage in human poisonings. Granotoxin I, which you will sometimes see referred to in older literature as acetylandrometal, and granotoxin III.
Okay. Granotoxin I and III.
Right. And these are fundamentally neurotoxins and cardiotoxins.
So this is where we really need to dig deep into the physiological mechanics. Because if a diterpene molecule from a Turkish rhododendron flower is not lighting up the brain's serotonin network to create a trip.
Right, it's not doing that.
Then how is it causing people to collapse? Like, how exactly does it short circuit the human body?
Well, to grasp the mechanism of granotoxins, we really have to zoom way in. We need to leave the macroscopic world of the Pontic Mountains and the bees and the flowers.
Okay, so zooming in.
And we need to descend to the microscopic level of human cellular machinery. We are looking specifically at the membrane of nerve and muscle cells. And there are these crucial structures embedded there known as voltage-gated sodium channels.
Voltage-gated sodium channels. I always try to visualize these as like the raw electrical switches of the body.
That is an incredibly accurate way to visualize them.
Yeah, they are the fundamental hardware that allows a thought to turn into a movement or a nerve signal to turn into an actual heartbeat.
Exactly. Every single nerve impulse traveling through your body and every single contraction of your heart muscle relies entirely on these microscopic channels. They are essentially these tiny, highly selective protein gates sitting right on the surface of your cells.
Okay.
For a nerve to fire, to send its signal down the line, that gate has to snap open. And when it opens, positively charged sodium ions rush into the cell from the outside.
Like opening a floodgate.
Yes. And this sudden influx of sodium changes the electrical charge of the cell. It's an event called depolarization.
Right, depolarization.
Mm-hmm.
But the key to the whole system is that the gate cannot stay open forever, right? I mean, the signal has to end eventually.
Exactly the point. The firing is only half the equation. Immediately after that gate opens and the sodium rushes in, a secondary mechanism swings into action. It's often described by biologists as a ball and chain structure on the protein.
A ball and chain. That's a great visual.
Yeah, it swings up and essentially plugs the channel. The channel must inactivate. It has to close and reset its electrical gradient so that the nerve can be ready to fire the very next signal.
So it's open, fire, close, reset.
Exactly. Open, fire, close, reset. And it happens in milliseconds.
It is a phenomenal, precise rhythm. I mean, our bodies are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But the granotoxins, these deuterotropin molecules, they completely disrupt that rhythm.
Oh, they wreck it.
Yeah, they literally wedge themselves into the machinery. And from what the journal notes, the specific binding site on the sodium channel where the granotoxin attaches, it's the exact same site targeted by some of the most lethal toxins on the entire planet.
Yes, receptor site 2.
Right, like aconitine from the monkshood plant and even batrachotoxin from poison dart frogs.
Yeah, the granotoxins are keeping incredibly dangerous company on a molecular level there. But the truly devious part of the granotoxin mechanism is its timing.
What do you mean?
Well, it cannot bind to a closed channel. It just waits in the cellular environment.
Ah.
It only binds to the channel when the channel is actively snapped open during a normal everyday nerve impulse.
Oh, wow. So it literally waits for the door to open and then it wedges its foot in the frame?
Yes. And once it binds, it chemically modifies the protein structure of the channel so that the ball and chain inactivation gate just cannot swing shut.
It blocks it.
It completely prevents the channel from inactivating. It physically jams the gate wide open.
Here's where it gets really interesting, at least to me, because I find this mechanism fascinating due to the cascade effect it creates.
The cascade is massive, yeah.
Yeah, like imagine you have an electronic doorbell on your front porch. Under normal circumstances, someone pushes the button, it completes the circuit, the chime rings once inside the house, the button pops back out, and the system resets.
Right.
Just waiting for the next visitor.
Right, a perfectly functioning system.
The granotoxin is the equivalent of someone walking up to your porch with a tube of industrial superglue, pressing the doorbell button all the way in, and gluing it permanently in place.
That's a great analogy.
I mean, the button cannot pop back out, it's stuck.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the consequence of that glued button is chaos.
Total chaos. The chime inside the house just keeps ringing and ringing and ringing endlessly without a pause.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, the transformer overheats, the wires melt, and the entire electrical system of the house just shorts out.
Taking that stuck doorbell analogy and applying it to the human nervous system gives us the exact clinical picture of mad honey poisoning. Because those microscopic sodium channels are jammed open, sodium ions just continuously pour into the cell.
Right.
The cell stays persistently depolarized. The result is that your nerves and your muscle cells begin firing uncontrollably. They are overstimulated to an extreme pathological degree.
Okay, but this brings up a massive contradiction that I really struggled with when I was initially reading the literature. And it is something we definitely need to untangle for you listening at home.
What's the contradiction?
Well, if the granotoxin is jamming the gates open, causing the nerves to fire constantly and uncontrollably, I mean, if the whole nervous system is wildly overstimulated, why does mad honey cause the human heart to slow down?
Oh, right.
Because logic kind of suggests that a bunch of overfiring nerves should make the heart race out of control. Like a massive adrenaline spike, you know?
It seems like it should, yes. That apparent paradox is the crux of why this toxin is so unique. And it all comes down to specific neuroanatomy.
Okay, neuroanatomy.
It is not just about the nerves firing faster. It is about which specific nerves are dominating the physiological response. When this massive, uncontrollable influx of sodium occurs, the body's reaction is entirely hijacked by one massive, heavily myelinated nerve pathway. The vagus nerve.
Oh, the vagus nerve. That's cranial nerve X, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh.
It literally wanders all the way from the brainstem down through the chest and deep into the abdomen. It is the absolute main highway of the parasympathetic nervous system. Basically, the system we usually associate with, like rest and digest.
Exactly. Though I would add that in this specific context, rest and digest is far too mild a term.
Fair enough.
because the vagus nerve is the great parasympathetic connection to the heart. In a healthy body, the vagus nerve acts as a gentle, constant brake on your heart rate. Your heart's natural pacemaker actually wants to beat quite fast.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, without regulation, it would race. So the vagus nerve drips this neurotransmitter called acetylcholine onto the heart to keep a steady resting rhythm of maybe 60 or 70 beats per minute.
I see. So when the granotoxins enter the system and start jamming all the sodium channels open, the vagus nerve is caught in the crossfire.
It is overactivated to an extreme degree. The vagus nerve just starts firing excessively, uncontrollably, dumping massive amounts of acetylcholine right onto the heart. And the specific receptors on the heart muscle that receive this acetylcholine signal are called M2 muscarinic receptors.
M2 muscarinic receptors. Okay, so the vagus nerve is basically screaming at the heart through these M2 receptors.
And the message it is screaming is an overwhelming command to slow down. It forcefully, violently slams the brakes on the heart. That vagal overactivation is the core life-threatening mechanism of mad honey poisoning.
So it's not damaging the heart itself?
No. It is not that the heart muscle itself is chemically broken or starved of oxygen. It is that the neurological brake pedal controlling the heart literally has a cinder block resting on it.
Man, the physiological implications of that cinder block on the brake pedal are terrifying. And looking at the clinical data in the OOTW journal, the symptoms are incredibly dose-dependent.
Oh, very much so.
It is a steep, slippery slope from a mild buzz to a full-blown cardiac emergency.
The dose dictates the danger entirely here. I mean, just a few extra grams of honey can completely alter the clinical outcome for a person.
Let's walk through the progression of what a person actually experiences when they ingest this stuff. At very low doses, which is basically what the traditional users in Turkey are aiming for, people report a mild, drunken feeling.
Right, a slight intoxication.
Yeah, they describe getting dizzy or slightly lightheaded. And there is a very specific localized effect, too. People often report tingling and numbness, usually concentrated around the mouth, the lips, and the hands.
Like a buzzing sensation.
Exactly. They might start sweating profusely, and they experience a euphoric buzz with slightly altered perception. And that is the edge of the cliff that these thrill seekers are dancing on.
But the margin of error between that euphoria and a medical crisis is just razor thin. If a consumer pushes into higher doses or honestly simply eats from a more concentrated patch of honeycomb, that euphoria disappears entirely.
It goes bad quickly.
The picture shifts immediately from an intoxicating buzz to acute toxicity.
The physical rejection begins. We are talking severe nausea, forceful vomiting, and hypersalivation, which completely makes sense given the overactivation of the parasympathetic nervous system, since it controls saliva production.
Right, the whole system is in overdrive.
People even report their vision blurring or literally splitting into double vision as the ocular muscles start to lose coordination, and then the severe cardiovascular emergencies take over.
This is where the statistical data provides a really grim, clear picture. The source material references a comprehensive systematic review by Gunduz et al. From 2023.
Oh, I remember that study.
Yeah, this study aggregated and analyzed 900 documented cases of mad honey poisoning. And in those 900 emergency room presentations, bradycardia, which is a dangerously pathologically slow heart rate, occurred in approximately 88% of the patients.
Wow. An 88% occurrence rate for profound bradycardia. That is an incredibly reliable signature symptom of the poison.
It is the defining clinical marker, without a doubt. Alongside the slow heart rate, hypotension, which is severely low blood pressure, appeared in about 76% of cases.
76%.
Right. The blood vessels essentially dilate while the heart slows down, which causes the pressure in the entire circulatory system to just collapse.
So there's no pressure pushing the blood anywhere.
Exactly. And in the most severe instances, this progression leads to syncope or fainting and atrioventricular block.
Atrioventricular block. Or AV block, as it's often called. That's when the electrical signals that tell the bottom chambers of the heart to contract are partially or completely blocked from the top chambers.
Right, that's right.
The heart is basically beating out of sync or just dropping beats entirely. And the journal notes that in rare cases, the massive neurological overstimulation can even trigger seizures.
Which brings us right back to the stark warning about the hallucinogenic honey branding we talked about earlier.
Oh, definitely.
If an individual purchases this product online, expecting a colorful, expanding LSD-like journey through their own consciousness, they are walking blindly into a trap. They are not getting a serotonergic psychedelic.
No, not at all.
They are ingesting a potent deliriant and a massive system-wide cardiotoxin.
Yeah, while some patients at higher doses do report altered perception or hallucination-like effects, the journal clarifies that frank, visual hallucinations are actually relatively uncommon.
Very uncommon.
The dependable, overwhelming, and life-threatening effect is on the cardiovascular system, not the visual field. You are essentially suffocating your own heart in the pursuit of a buzz.
And this exact mechanism, the profound dropping of the blood pressure, the slowing of the heart to a crawl, the total physical incapacitation of the victim, is what made this honey so much more than just a modern medical curiosity.
It really did.
That specific physiological collapse turned this sticky sweet substance into a devastating ancient weapon.
The deep history of mad honey is genuinely one of my favorite aspects of this entire topic. I mean, mad honey has one of the most thoroughly documented histories of any natural intoxicant in the world.
It's an incredible historical record.
And that is specifically because it kept showing up as a biological hazard in ancient war zones.
The historical accounts provide a fascinating lens here because they allow us to see the exact same pharmacology we just discussed, the jammed sodium channels and the vagal nerve overactivation playing out on a macro scale. Centuries before anyone even knew what a molecule was.
It's wild to think about. The earliest documented account in the historical record goes all the way back to 401 BC. We have the writings of the Greek historian and soldier Xenophon in his famous work, The Anabasis.
A classic text.
Yeah. He is describing the grueling journey of his army of Greek mercenaries, known as the 10,000. They're retreating from a failed campaign deep in the Persian Empire, marching through this incredibly hostile territory, and they finally reach the Black Sea coast, near modern-day Trabzon in Turkey.
Right, and they are completely exhausted.
Exhausted, starving, and they stumble upon these villages surrounded by local beehives.
Given their condition and, you know, the universal appeal of honey as a high-calorie food source, they naturally raided the hives. They gorged themselves on the honeycombs.
And the entire encamped army just goes down. Xenophon's clinical description of the event is incredible to read today. He writes that the soldiers who only ate a little bit of the honey acted incredibly drunk, stumbling around and losing their coordination.
That's a low dose effect.
Exactly. But the soldiers who ate a lot of it behaved like madmen, vomiting and suffering from diarrhea. Eventually, hundreds of them just collapsed and lay on the ground as if they were dead, completely unable to stand.
When we view Xenophon's account through the lens of modern toxicology, he is perfectly describing the dose-dependent progression of granotoxin poisoning. I mean, it's textbook.
It really is.
The men who acted drunk were experiencing the low-dose dizziness and ataxia. The men lying on the ground as if dead were experiencing the profound bradycardia and severe hypotension.
Right, the heart block.
Their blood pressure bottomed out, their heart rates probably dropped into the 30s or 40s, and they suffered massive syncope. They were functionally incapacitated by the vagal response.
Fortunately for those Greeks, there was no enemy army waiting in the trees to take advantage of their collapse. Xenophon notes that there were actually no fatalities that day.
Very lucky for them.
The soldiers lay on the ground for about 24 hours and then slowly began to recover their senses. They eventually managed to pull themselves together and march on. But if you fast forward roughly three centuries to the first century BC, during the Third Mithridatic War.
Ah, yes.
In this instance, the mass poisoning was absolutely not an accident of foraging.
No, in the Mithridatic War, we see a deliberate, calculated, and highly effective use of biological warfare.
The allies of King Mithridates, this local tribal group known as the Heptacomites, they were intimately familiar with the local ecology. They knew exactly what the spring honey in the Pontic Mountains did to the human body.
They'd seen it before.
Oh, yeah. So they gathered massive quantities of mad honeycombs and intentionally left them right along the path where the advancing Roman legions commanded by Pompey the Great would inevitably find them. It is the ultimate literal honey trap.
It's brilliant in its simplicity. The Roman soldiers, much like the Greeks before them, found this seemingly abandoned bounty of high-energy food. They ate it, they succumbed to the granotoxins, and they completely collapsed.
And once the Roman soldiers were immobilized by the bradycardia and the hypotension, unable to lift their weapons or even stand up, the Heptacomites swept out of the mountains and massacred them.
It's a brutal story, but this raises an important question regarding how we interpret ancient history.
Oh, for sure.
While the biological reality of this ambush is totally sound, analyzing these ancient accounts requires a degree of historiographical caution. The source material notes that the ancient historian Strabo, who documented this event, claimed that three entire Roman cohorts were wiped out in this specific ambush.
Three cohorts? That's a lot of guys, right?
A cohort was roughly 400 to 500 men, so Strabo is suggesting around 1,500 highly trained Roman soldiers were slaughtered by local tribesmen using honey.
1,500.
As consumers of history, we always have to view exact casualty numbers from ancient historians with a degree of healthy skepticism. Ancient writers routinely inflated numbers for dramatic effect, to highlight the savagery of foreign lands, or even just for political propaganda.
I agree. The logistics of gathering enough toxic honeycomb to simultaneously incapacitate 1,500 battle-hardened Romans in a single afternoon seems, well, stretched. The specific body count might well be embellished by Strabo.
Very likely embellished. However, while the body count may be exaggerated, the underlying biological mechanism and the strategic use of the honey are genuinely documented historical realities.
Because the symptoms match up perfectly.
Exactly. The physical symptoms that both Xenophon and Strabo describe align perfectly with modern clinical presentations of acute granotoxin poisoning. I mean, they had absolutely no concept of voltage-dated sodium channels, but they observed and recorded the exact physiological consequences of jamming those gates open.
It is a stunning realization to think about a highly disciplined Roman military force being defeated by the chemical defenses of a rhododendron shrub.
It puts human might into perspective.
It really does. But this deep history in the Black Sea region isn't just ancient trivia trapped in a textbook. The Black Sea coast of Turkey remains the absolute epicenter of where the most dangerous delible harvesting happens today.
Right, it's still very active.
But it is not the only extreme environment where this cultural practice thrives. The source material pulls our attention from the Pontic Alps over to the Himalayas.
The harvest of mad honey is very much a living cultural tradition, and it occurs in some of the most unforgiving vertical terrain on Earth.
Because the harvest in Turkey is largely done by local beekeepers managing hives, kind of like normal beekeeping. But the Nepalese harvest is on another level entirely.
Oh, completely different.
In the remote mountainous regions of Nepal, they are dealing with a completely different insect, the Himalayan giant honeybee, scientifically known as Apis laboriosa. These are some of the largest honeybees in the world.
Huge bees.
And these bees do not build nice, accessible wooden box hives in a meadow. They build enormous crescent-shaped nests under overhangs on sheer, vertical stone cliff faces.
The indigenous Gurung honey hunters of Nepal are the people who undertake this specific harvest. And it is just a staggering feat of human endurance, traditional engineering, and raw bravery.
I want you to really visualize the sheer terrifying reality of this harvest. The Gurung hunters climb hundreds of feet up these sheer stone cliffs.
Without modern gear.
Right. They are not using modern carabiners or static ropes or climbing harnesses. They are scaling fragile, handmade rope ladders constructed from woven bamboo.
It's unbelievable.
And the wind at that altitude is just howling against the cliff face. They build massive fires at the base of the cliff, and the climbers are completely surrounded by thick, choking smoke that they use to try and pacify the bees.
And despite the smoke, they are still being swarmed by thousands of giant, aggressive honeybees.
All while balancing precariously on a swaying bamboo ladder, using a long wooden pole to carefully slice away sections of a heavy, sticky honeycomb and catching it in a basket lowered from above.
One wrong move.
Yeah, one slip of the foot, one moment of panic from a bee sting, and that is a fatal drop.
It is breathtakingly dangerous. It is no wonder that this specific Himalayan harvest has become one of the most photographed, filmed, and documented cultural rituals on the planet. I mean, it is visually and viscerally stunning.
National Geographic has done some amazing pieces on it.
Yes, they have. And the honey they harvest from these cliffs, particularly the spring honey derived from the high elevation rhododendron slopes, is known to be the most chemically potent and therefore the most economically prized on the market.
So what does this all mean? Which naturally brings us to a massive question regarding human behavior and risk assessment.
Always a complex topic.
We have established that acquiring this honey requires literally scaling a Himalayan cliff face, risking a deadly fall, enduring giant bee stings, and, once you get the honey, risking a massive heart block and extreme hypotension from the granotoxin itself.
Right. A lot of risk.
Given all of those compounding vectors of danger, why on earth is there still a massive, lucrative global market for this stuff today? Who is actually seeking this out and eating it?
Well, the modern demographic driving the demand for mad honey is largely fueled by its deeply ingrained reputation as a powerful folk medicine.
Folk medicine.
Yes. Across its native ranges in Turkey and Nepal, local populations take it in tiny, carefully measured amounts, usually just a small spoonful stirred into hot water or taken directly on an empty stomach. They utilize it as a traditional remedy to treat a wide array of ailments.
Like what kind of ailments?
Things like high blood pressure, diabetes, stomach ulcers, sore throats, and joint pain from arthritis.
Okay, I have to pause on the high blood pressure claim. Because using a known powerful cardiotoxin that functions by drastically, uncontrollably lowering blood pressure to treat chronic hypertension. I mean, I can see the very dangerous, unregulated logic there, but it is effectively using a sledgehammer to tap in a nail.
That is a very apt metaphor. It is an extreme, highly volatile form of self-medication. The rationale is that since the toxin lowers blood pressure, a microdose might manage hypertension.
It's so risky.
It is the equivalent of playing with fire. However, while the folk medicine aspect sustains the local markets, the most significant driver of modern poisonings, particularly among people importing it or buying it online, is its aggressive marketing as a potent aphrodisiac and a sexual performance enhancer.
And there's the tragic, inevitable irony of the modern mad honey trade.
Yeah.
Because I look closely at the pharmacological research in the OBTW journal, and absolutely none of these traditional medicinal claims, and especially not the aphrodisiac claims, have ever been scientifically validated by clinical trials.
You're a single one.
There is zero peer-reviewed evidence that granotoxins improve sexual performance. But what is proven, beyond a shadow of a doubt in emergency rooms across the globe, is that the honey causes real, life-threatening cardiovascular poisonings.
The clinical data reflects this tragic irony perfectly. When you look at the demographic of documented victims turning up in emergency rooms today with mad honey poisoning, the profile is overwhelmingly consistent.
Who is it usually?
It is predominantly middle-aged men, and they are poisoning themselves because they were chasing that reputed sexual enhancement effect.
Oh, wow.
They take a spoonful, feel nothing immediately, take a larger dose, hoping for a stronger effect, and they end up in the back of an ambulance with a heart rate of 35 beats per minute.
And the real danger here, beyond the sheer potency of the toxin, is something the journal emphasizes heavily. The complete and utter unpredictability of the product.
You are essentially playing chemical roulette every single time you put a spoon into a jar of mad honey.
Chemical roulette? That's terrifying.
The granotoxin content in a single serving can swing wildly from negligible to lethal. It depends on the specific species of rhododendron the bees happen to visit that week. It depends heavily on the season. Spring honey is vastly more toxic than autumn honey.
Because of the blooms, right?
Yes. It depends on the rainfall, the soil composition, and the specific elevation of the flowers.
The journal even pointed out that the toxicity can vary wildly from one part of the exact same honeycomb to another.
Yes.
Like, you could have a safe spoonful from the left side of the comb and a highly toxic spoonful from the right side.
And this unpredictability is especially dangerous when dealing with raw, single hive honey, which is precisely the type highly sought after by purists and thrill seekers who want the most authentic product.
Because it's not blended.
Right. Standard commercial mass market honey sold in grocery stores is blended from thousands of different hives across different regions, which drastically dilutes any localized toxins to completely harmless levels.
Right. Homogenization.
Exactly. But a jar of single hive deli ball is a concentrated, undiluted dose of whatever those specific bees were foraging on in that specific mountain valley. The consumer has absolutely zero way to quantify or know what dose of granotoxin they are actually ingesting.
So you and I could both take an identical spoonful from the exact same artisanal jar. I might get a mild, dizzy buzz, and you might end up in full cardiac arrest.
Precisely. It is completely arbitrary.
It is terrifying. But, and this is a crucial point of context we really need to provide, despite all this inherent danger, people are not dropping dead left and right today the way Pompey's legions did.
Thankfully, no.
The source material mentions that systematic review of 1,199 modern documented clinical cases of mad honey poisoning. Out of those almost 1,200 people who had to go to the hospital, how many deaths were recorded in that specific review?
Zero. In that particular systematic review covering nearly 1,200 modern cases, there were zero fatalities recorded.
Zero. That is an astounding statistic given that the toxin functionally stops the heart.
It is an encouraging statistic regarding modern emergency medicine, but we must be incredibly careful not to misinterpret it. Just because fatalities are rare in a modern medical setting where intervention is immediate does not mean the substance is harmless.
Oh, absolutely not.
The profound bradycardia and hypotension are incredibly dangerous medical emergencies. They routinely land patients in the intensive care unit.
And for anyone who is elderly, or for anyone living with an underlying, maybe undiagnosed heart condition, I mean, that massive sudden drop in blood pressure and heart rate can absolutely be fatal. The cardiovascular system just might not have the resilience to bounce back.
Historical fatalities clearly exist, and rare modern fatalities are documented in the broader medical literature outside of that specific 1199 case review. When you consume mad honey, you are walking right up to the edge of a very steep cliff. The fact that modern doctors are very good at catching you before you hit the bottom does not make standing on the edge safe.
Which brings us to the medical rescue. If these thrill seekers and middle-aged men are walking right up to the edge of the cliff and falling off, how do modern doctors actually pull them back? Like, what happens when someone gets wheeled into the ER, sweating, vomiting, and suffering from a massively depressed heart rate after losing this chemical roulette?
Well, the good news is that, from a clinical perspective, man-honey poisoning is highly treatable if the medical staff recognizes what they're dealing with.
If they know what it is.
Right. The symptoms usually hit anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours after ingestion. It depends on the dose and whether it was taken on an empty stomach. The crisis usually peaks around the two-hour mark.
And how long does it take for the body to clear the toxin and get out of the woods?
For most otherwise healthy patients, it is a self-limiting condition. It usually resolves in about 24 hours as the liver and kidneys naturally metabolize and clear the granotoxins from the bloodstream.
Okay, 24 hours.
Though in highly severe cases, it can take up to 72 hours for the electrical rhythms of the heart to fully stabilize and normalize.
But during those initial 24 hours, if your heart is beating at 30 beats a minute and your blood pressure is in the basement, you need aggressive medical intervention. You cannot just sleep it off on a couch.
Definitely not. The absolute mainstay of treatment is supportive care combined with continuous electrocardiogram or EKG monitoring to watch for those AV blocks or arrhythmias.
Right.
And the primary pharmacological reversal they use in the ER is actually quite elegant in its simplicity, because we know that the poison works by indirectly overactivating the vagus nerve, which then dumps acetylcholine onto the heart's muscarinic receptors to slam the brakes.
Right, cinder block on the brake pedal.
Doctors can administer a specific counter drug called atropine.
I want to break down exactly how atropine works here, because it is a perfect chemical counterstrike. Atropine acts as a competitive antagonist at those M2 muscarinic receptors on the heart.
A competitive antagonist, meaning it competes with the acetylcholine for the same exact parking spot on the cell, but it does not activate the receptor when it parks there.
Exactly. If the vagus nerve is a heavy foot slamming down on the brake pedal of the heart, atropine physically wedges itself underneath the brake pedal.
That's exactly it.
It blocks the acetylcholine from binding. It physically takes the brakes off, allowing the heart's natural pacemaker to safely climb back up to a normal sustaining rhythm.
It is a brilliant piece of modern pharmacology, neutralizing a natural toxin. But restoring the heart rate is only part of the solution. They also have to address the crashing blood pressure.
Because the vessels are still dilated.
Yes. So alongside the atropine, emergency physicians will use intravenous saline fluids to rapidly boost the patient's blood volume. If the blood pressure remains critically low despite the fluids and the atropine, they will administer vasopressors.
Vasopressors, so they squeeze the pipes?
Exactly. These are medications that force the peripheral blood vessels to constrict, physically squeezing the vascular system to force the blood pressure back up to a safe level to ensure the brain and the vital organs are receiving enough oxygen.
This entire clinical picture is such a crucial takeaway for you listening right now. Obviously, we hope you never find yourself in a situation where you need this information. But recognizing obscure, seemingly unconnected symptoms can literally save a life.
It absolutely can.
If you are at a dinner party or traveling abroad, and someone consumes some exotic, imported, raw, artisanal honey, and 20 minutes later they are dizzy, sweating profusely, nauseous, and they suddenly develop a mysterious, profoundly slow heart rate. Knowing this highly specific piece of natural history could be the difference between a baffling mystery in the ER and a rapid, targeted, life-saving treatment with atropine.
Knowledge is highly protective. When you understand the underlying molecular mechanism, a bizarre, terrifying medical presentation suddenly makes perfect sense. The mystery is removed and the treatment path becomes instantly clear.
It really does. Looking back at everything we have covered today, what an incredible winding journey this substance takes. Just to synthesize everything we have unpacked, Mad Honey Delabol is a staggering marvel of natural chemistry and ecological interplay.
It truly is a marvel.
You have these complex deterpenine plant toxins produced as an evolutionary defense mechanism by mountain rhododendrons. These toxins are innocently ferried by immune, unwitting honeybees and concentrated into the honeycomb. And when a human consumes that honey, those exact molecules wedge themselves into the voltage-gated sodium channels in our nervous system, jamming them wide open.
Which initiates the cascade. The open channels cause relentless nerve firing, which panics the vagus nerve, which in turn dumps acetylcholine onto the heart, slamming the brakes and dropping blood pressure to the floor.
It is the exact same biological, cellular mechanism that incapacitated ancient Greek soldiers on the shores of the Black Sea, that wiped out Roman legions in a calculated ambush, and that continues to send modern thrill seekers to the intensive care unit after climbing Himalayan cliffs.
It's unchanged history.
The euphoria, the traditional medicine, and the life-threatening danger are quite literally the exact same molecule. You cannot taste the difference on the spoon.
And exploring that deception leads to a much broader and, frankly, a much more provocative thought to leave you with today. We have just spent an hour detailing how common honeybees can safely, silently sequester a potent, heart-stopping neurotoxin in something as mundane and universally trusted as honey.
It really makes you look at your pantry and everything we consider natural differently.
It forces us to ask a larger ecological question. How many other everyday insects are silently ferrying powerful pharmacological compounds from wild flora directly into human food chains?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
We tend to look at nature as neatly categorized into distinct boxes of food and poison, but Mad Honey proves that those lines are entirely blurred by the biological intermediaries.
If a bee can package a cardiotoxin into breakfast food without noticing, what else is slipping through?
Exactly. Could the next major medical breakthrough, perhaps a highly targeted novel heart medication, or a revolutionary new anesthetic derived from a plant toxin, or conversely, a completely undiscovered deadly hazard, be hiding in plain sight?
Just sitting on a shelf.
Right. Could it be sitting in the local jams, the wild foraged fruits, or the artisanal syrup sitting in our very own kitchens right now, just waiting for the right scientific instrument or the right unfortunate accident to reveal its true chemical nature?
That is a staggering thought to mull over the next time you open a jar of anything labeled wild foraged or raw. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration into the bizarre, deceptive, and incredibly complex world of Mad Honey inspires you to keep questioning the hidden chemistry of the natural world around you.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes the most dangerous, history-altering secret can look just like a spoonful of sweet, reddish honey. Catch you on the next one.